CityTalk 105.9, official podcasts, online at citytalk.fm. CityTalk 105.9, the best of Roy Basnett.
Hello and welcome to this week's podcast. Each week we will be bringing you some of the best moments from our award-winning programme on CityTalk 105.9, The Voice of Liverpool. This week we're going to hear from a couple of very interesting people. We start off with Dr. Ian Griffin. He is a local astronomer who used to work for NASA. I spoke to him about some very exciting stuff which you can see in the night skies. Plus, he also told me about working on the Hubble telescope, the future of the space shuttle, and man's next trip to the moon. And also, could it be that a planet may collide with the Earth in the next few years? Have a listen and find out.
CityTalk 105.9, the best of Roy Basnett.
Right then, Ian, you are, I suppose it's a fair term to use, a local astronomer and a former employee with NASA. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got into astronomy and what your role with NASA was?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've always been passionate about astronomy ever since I was a really young kid. I guess I grew up in the 60s. I was about 3 when they landed on the moon. Mm-hmm. And I think for kids growing up at that time, you know, you were surrounded by people landing on the moon, and, you know, the notion of going into space was very, very exciting. So from there, I got into Star Trek, and that's how I ended up as being an astronomer.
I'm just wondering whether or not there's some kind of prerequisite on the application form that at some point in your life you had to be a Trekkie.
Well, I think, I mean, Trekkie is such a brilliant universe, isn't it? It's very imaginative. And I think, I'm sure it inspired a whole generation of people to go into astronomy or into science, because I know lots of my friends, you know, when they're drunk, will confess to enjoying a good old episode of Star Trek.
Mm-hmm. So what about your involvement with NASA?
Well, that started out because I did studies in astronomy and then started getting interested in getting people excited about astronomy and working in observatories and planetariums around the world. In 2001, I was hired to take over the whole of the education and outreach program for the Space Telescope program, which is the Hubble telescope.
Mm-hmm.
So for about 4 years, I saw all the Hubble pictures before they got out to the public, and was part of the team that then kind of used them to promote education and science. So it's a very, very exciting time to be
there.
Yeah,
I was going to say, it must have been quite exciting.
Yeah, well, Hubble is a brilliant program. I mean, the telescope, I mean, it was launched in 1990, and it's been up there almost 19 years now.
Hmm.
And it is just an amazing discovery machine. It's probably one of the best telescopes ever built, and certainly one of the most productive scientific instruments ever built. And the results from it have absolutely revolutionized astronomy. So for an astronomer to be able to work on that kind of project was very, very exciting indeed.
Well, what is the main purpose of the Hubble telescope?
Well, it was originally designed to basically understand the expansion of the universe and kind of calibrate our distance scale in the universe. Now, that was why it was designed, but actually because it was the first telescope, or certainly one of the first big telescopes to be put up above the Earth's atmosphere, it was able to make a huge number of discoveries which weren't thought of when the telescope was built. And one of the nice things about Hubble is it was designed to be updated. So even though it was launched back in 1990, it's been visited 4 times so far by space shuttle crews who've basically upgraded the cameras and repaired bits that fell off or went wrong.
Mm.
And there's another and final servicing mission going up to the telescope in May. So again, Hubble's instruments are going to be updated, and it's going to be up there productively discovering new things well through the middle of the next decade.
Right. So it seems such a probably it's just too simple a term to use, telescope, because I mean obviously the perception that we would have of a telescope would be this white tube thing with a couple of lenses in it and stuff like that, but obviously the Hubble is a bit more complex than that, I would have thought, Ian.
Well, I mean, at its most basic level, I mean, Hubble is a big mirror with another mirror out there in space. The complicated thing about Hubble is that it's going around the Earth, moving at about 17,000 miles an hour, and it's got to be programmed weeks and months in advance about what it should be viewing and how it should take pictures.
Right.
So the actual telescope itself is very simple and relatively similar to the one that Isaac Newton built about 300 or 400 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The complicated thing is the control system. And it's the pointing system and the computers that are needed to kind of make sure that all of the pictures it takes are sent down to Earth and processed.
Right. I mean, in terms of me speaking here at a purely ignorant level, what kind of distance would it be able to see?
Well, actually, I mean, that's one of the funny things about telescopes. I mean, people often say, how far can you see with it? Well, actually, with your own eyes, you can see a hell of a long way because, obviously, stars are a long way away.
Yeah.
And although Hubble can certainly see a long way out into the universe, the most important thing that it can do is really two things. It's incredibly sensitive, so it can see very, very dim things.
Mm-hmm.
It can see things that are millions of times dimmer than you can see with your eyes. But it's also, because it's above the Earth's atmosphere, it can see incredible detail. One of the problems about living on the Earth is the atmosphere. Now, obviously, we all need it to breathe. But if you're an astronomer, you really hate the Earth's atmosphere because it wobbles around. And you can actually see this for yourself. I don't know if you've ever been out on a clear night. If you look up, you see the stars seem to twinkle. Twinkling is caused by motions in the Earth's atmosphere.
Right. I didn't know that.
And while it's very, very pretty, I mean, we all love the twinkling stars, don't we? As I say, if you're an astronomer and you're trying to take a detailed picture of those stars, they wobble about, and that's really frustrating, and it blurs the pictures.
Right.
So, of course, the real benefit of Hubble is you're above the Earth's atmosphere, you don't have any interfering atmosphere, and you can get these exquisitely detailed pictures. And Hubble takes beautiful pictures of planets. It's studied galaxies in outer space. And the range of activity that you can do with the telescope is absolutely phenomenal.
Right.
And as I say, perhaps, you know, I'm very enthusiastic about it, obviously because I work there. But I think the Hubble has sent back not just some of the most interesting science ever to come back in astronomy. It's also taken some of the most beautiful pictures. I mean, I defy you to look at Hubble image of Saturn or one of its images of these distant galaxies and not be absolutely moved. And in fact, some of them look like paintings. They're so beautiful.
Mm. Yeah, detail.
Yes, I mean, it's a fantastic project. And as I say, one of the nice things about it is that it is built to be repaired. And although the Americans spent a hell of a lot of money on it, it was about a $5 billion project. So an awful lot of money went into this telescope. It is going to be upgraded and updated this year.
Yeah.
And it's going to be working well through, you know, as I say, the middle of the next decade.
Well, of course, that works out well for the 2009 year of astronomy, which we'll come back to in a short while. But what I'd like to do now, if it's all right, Ian, is I want to move a bit further into science fiction. That may well turn out to be science facts. There's a lot of speculation about galactic events happening in the future. What can you tell us about these suspected things, Ian?
Well, actually, that's a very interesting question. People often think that astronomy must be a really boring subject because, you know, astronomers consider things that take millions or billions of years in some cases. But actually, the universe we live in is a very dynamic place. And you can see that. I mean, we know our own star, the Sun, has a sunspot cycle that every 11 years, you know, the number of sunspots change. Beyond that, we can sometimes see stars exploding. And we know in the past, really amazingly dynamic events have happened here on Earth. For example, about 65 million years ago, a really large comet hit the Earth, and that's probably the reason that we have no dinosaurs around today.
Right.
So although, you know, people often think of astronomy as being a pretty esoteric thing, actually astronomy can tell us an awful lot about how life started on the Earth and our future prospects for life continuing.
Mm, but what you're talking about then, this comet that hit the Earth and wiped out the dinosaurs, obviously had, you know, catastrophic events for effects for what life was on the planet at the time. Something similar happening in this day and age would potentially give us the same outcome, would it not?
Well, absolutely, and that's one of the reasons and one of the values of astronomy, because there are a number of search programs out there. There are astronomers who every clear night scan the skies looking for objects that might hit the Earth. So obviously, you know, stopping them is a bit of a problem, but the search programs will probably give us, you know, some warning that one of these things might hit us. And that should give us enough time to perhaps figure out a way of moving it so that it doesn't hit the Earth. But certainly, you know, as I say, there are a large number of things that can happen out there in the universe that could directly affect us here on the Earth. As I say, comets hitting the Earth, asteroids, stars could explode. All sorts of things go on out there.
So you could say that the Hubble telescope in itself acts as an early warning system.
Well, actually, Hubble's not used for kind of, because it's got such a powerful system, it can see a very small part of the universe in some detail. So if you're looking for things, you need a much broader view.
Right.
So that Hubble tends not to be used for hunting for new comets and new asteroids. Those hunts are done by other astronomers using ground-based telescopes.
Mm.
And there are telescopes in Australia and California and New Mexico that, as I say, every clear night are hunting for these things.
I'm a little bit concerned, obviously, because those poor old dinosaurs getting wiped out by this comet. I mean, if it happened once, there's a possibility it could happen again. When was the last time something significant, after the dinosaurs, that is, actually hit the planet?
Well, we're being hit all the time. I mean, and again, I wouldn't want you, your listeners to go out and sort of... what's the word, putting things under the pillows and wearing tin hats, because, yeah, undoubtedly, the Earth has been hit in the past, and it will be hit in the future. But luckily, events that are catastrophic are very rare. You know, a dinosaur-type extinction event is, as say, certainly tens of millions of years, if not hundreds of millions of years type of event. Whereas, as I say, every clear night, you can actually see rocks from space hitting the Earth's atmosphere and burning up. They're called meteors.
All right.
So to answer your question directly, though, I mean, back in 1908, a comet was thought to enter the Earth's atmosphere and explode above Siberia, and that's, you may have heard of something called the Tunguska event.
Can't say I have, no.
Which was a large forest in Siberia was basically blown apart, or not blown apart, that's over-egging the situation. The forest... The comet exploded above the forest and flattened trees throughout this area of Siberia. In 1999, I was living in New Zealand, and a relatively small asteroid blew up about 30 miles above New Zealand and was seen from the whole of New Zealand. So these things are seen quite regularly, although the really big ones are very rare, and it's very unlikely that we're going to be hit, certainly within the next... well, certainly within our lifetimes, I think.
Well, that's very reassuring to know. We're talking with Ian Griffin this morning, an astronomer and former employee with NASA here on City Talk 105.9. It's Beyond the Dark, our weekly look at the world of the paranormal, strange things, and, of course, UFOs and things relating to the galaxy. I've got to ask you this one as well, and perhaps maybe you could shed some light on it, because this has been a real bone of contention with us here on this show. Is it true that in the 1980s that NASA discovered another planet referred to as Nibiru?
No, it's not.
It's not true.
The planets and, well, relatively small planets are discovered all the time, and we call them asteroids. And there are thousands and thousands of these things. But I know there's the Nibiru thing is something that was, I'm trying to remember where I saw it. It was one of these internet discussion groups, wasn't it? Is that right?
Well, there's plenty of stuff about it now, and it really there are so many conspiracies and all manner of things that come about as a result of it.
Well, I think, I mean, that's, I guess I'm a simple person at heart, and I guess I've worked, I'm lucky enough to work for NASA, and I know NASA is such an organization that it's so, in many ways, it's a fantastically competent organization. But everybody knows what's going on, and it would be incredibly difficult to hide any information like that away from those people who could do anything about it.
So if there was a planet that had been discovered and it's heading towards the Earth, then we would know about it now. Somebody would have leaked that information.
Well, absolutely. And in fact, anybody with access to an internet connection can actually see what the astronomers are looking at every night. And anybody who knows a little bit of maths can actually use the information that astronomers publish openly on the internet to make their own predictions and test whether these things are going to hit us or not. Mm-hmm. So I would say, as I say, even though, you know, conspiracy theories are very much the rage, it would be so difficult to hide something as important as that I guess I would always kind of err on the side of the fact that the difficulty of hiding it is such that it would come out.
Right, I see. Okay, then, let's just go back to some of the points that you made earlier, and I'm still having a little bit of difficulty comprehending this. The universe is constantly expanding. Could you kind of put that into layman's terms for us, if it's possible to do that, Ian?
Well, I guess there are many ways of thinking about this. I mean, astronomers tell us that the universe was created in a huge explosion, 15 billion years ago or so. And since that time, the universe has been expanding. And because we are used to living in a three-dimensional world, some of the concepts get quite complicated. And an analogy I quite like is if you ever get a balloon and you blow it up, And if you draw spots on the surface of the balloon, all of those spots are moving away from each other. And that, I guess, in two dimensions, is exactly what's going on in the universe.
Right.
On a bigger level.
Right. Interesting stuff. 2009, the year we're in at the moment, apparently is the year of astronomy. What kind of things can we expect this year then, Ian?
Well, there's a fantastic array of things going on all over the world, because obviously, why 2009, you might say? It's 400 years since Galileo first pointed his telescope at the sky, and that single event really transformed our understanding of the universe, because, of course, Galileo discovered craters on the moon, and he was the first person to see the moons of Jupiter, and all sorts of very interesting things. So astronomers the world over want to celebrate this fact, and there's a whole year which will be a real celebration of the universe and use astronomy as a theme to bring people together all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a number of websites which I would point people to, because there are so many things going on, not just, you know, all over the world, but actually all over the country. And if you go to astronomy2009.co.uk, you can actually log into that site and see all of the events that are going on throughout the country, and I'm sure that there will be an event somewhere
close
by, to you.
Yeah.
Because there are literally so many of them going on over the course of the year.
Yeah. If people wish to conduct their own astronomical research, if you like, what kind of a telescope would they need to get? Are there any basics on this?
Well, anybody that... I started out without a telescope, and actually my dad bought me a pair of binoculars when I was about 7 or 8 years old. And a really good pair of binoculars is probably the best start that anybody can have for learning the sky. And, you know, as I say, my favourite, you know, the best pieces of equipment you can have is a pair of binoculars and a deck chair. Literally go in your back garden and sit there and get yourself a simple star chart, and you can learn the sky. Now, there's nearly always something interesting up there in the sky. For example, I'm sure your listeners, if they've been out in the evening over the last few weeks, in the western sky, you can't have missed the planet Venus, because it is absolutely stonkingly bright.
Oh, right. Is that what it is?
It is.
I have noticed the bright star in the sky, and that you have just kind of told me what it was. I didn't know what it was.
Well, that's right. And as I say, I mean, oftentimes people think, oh, well, you know, if you want to get into astronomy, you've got to have an incredibly powerful telescope. Well, actually, with a pair of binoculars that most people have probably got at home somewhere, you know, nearly everybody's got a pair of binoculars somewhere. If you take that pair of binoculars and you look at Venus, you should be able to see its phase, which varies over the next few weeks and months. With that simple pair of binoculars, you can also see some of the craters of the moon. And if you know where to look, you can find Jupiter and look at Jupiter's moons as well. So there's a lot you can see very simply. But if you really want to get into astronomy, and as I say, it's a bit, I suppose it's like any hobby. If you start out and you get addicted, you want to go and get more and more kit and more and more equipment.
Yeah.
And you can spend literally as much as you want, because there are, as I say, some very, very amazing telescopes available now for amateur astronomers, which can do some incredible things.
What kind of things can we expect in the future, Ian, in terms of technology, that what NASA might be working on at the moment that really, really is, certainly going to move the research programs forward and perhaps maybe even the actual transportation into space?
Well, I think we're living in very exciting times. At the moment, NASA are in the process of deciding what they're going to do next after the space shuttle, because the space shuttle is going to be retiring.
Yeah, I believe so, yeah.
And obviously, the space shuttle has been America's route into space since the early 1980s. Now, after the accidents that happened with the space shuttles, George Bush, the president, decided that, you know, they were going to retire the shuttle. And NASA are now working on the next generation rocket, which will hopefully get people up into space, into Earth orbit. But even more exciting, it might even start getting people back to the moon and beyond.
Mm.
So there is, and again, obviously there's new administration coming in America and things might change. But there is a plan to try and land on the moon in the early part of the 2020 decade. And that would be done using a new rocket system called Ares, which is a bit like a throwback to the 1960s. It's a rocket of the type, a wee bit smaller than the ones that the Apollo astronauts flew to the moon.
Mm.
So obviously there's new rockets coming on board. With regards to technology, though, and the next generation telescopes, NASA have got plans to launch an even bigger telescope than Hubble into space in around 2015, and that's called the James Webb Space Telescope. And that would have a mirror about roughly three times bigger than Hubble. Hubble's about 2.4 meters, and the Webb telescope is around 6 meters in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
And that telescope will see even further into space, see even finer detail than Hubble, and will tell us information about the very early phases of the universe.
Right.
But actually, here on Earth, there are some even more exciting things going on.
Right.
You probably when I was growing up, the biggest telescope in the world was the famous Mount Palomar telescope, which had a mirror about 200 inches across. Now the biggest telescopes on Earth have mirrors around 400 inches across, or roughly 10 meters in diameter. There are plans to build telescopes that have mirrors of either 30 or as big as 100 meters across. And one of these has got the I always laugh with some of these names, but one of these telescopes projects has the name the Overwhelmingly Large Telescope because it's so enormous. And with these, you know, these telescopes are so much bigger than the existing telescopes that they will certainly give us a lot of information about the very early universe, and they'll make discoveries about things that we haven't even thought of at the moment.
That's incredible. If I could just come back to the space travel thing and the landing on the moon. A lot of people will ask this question: why is it that it is going to take so long? I mean, we're talking about 2020 before we might go back to the moon. Why is it going to take so long when we managed to get to the moon in the 1960s?
Well, I think that's a question many people ask. Basically, I think it's probably fair to say that, you know, the Apollo program going to the moon was really a relic of the Cold War. And it was a program that President Kennedy set up specifically to kind of basically show that America could do things better than Russia. And I really think that when President Nixon came into the, you know, came in the late 1960s, the Apollo program was incredibly expensive. I mean, to put those 12 men on the moon cost billions and billions and billions of dollars. And I think that was during the time of Vietnam, and a reassessment was made. So the Apollo program, if it had been extended or continued, certainly we'd be on probably the planet Mars by now. But as I say, the politicians decided they wanted to kind of to go back. And actually, the space shuttle, which was, you know, sold as a replacement to Apollo, was very limited because obviously the space shuttle can't go outside Earth orbit. And the space station, which was what the space shuttle was designed to build, really, you know, that itself took much longer to build. And even now, the space station, I think most people would agree, is not doing a very useful task. I mean, it's up there, it orbits the Earth, it's getting bigger and bigger, but the research that's coming out of it isn't perhaps as valuable as we would all
intended.
Hope.
Yeah. So basically what you're saying, that the sheer expense of it would probably make it impractical at the moment.
Certainly at the moment, although things are changing. I mean, until fairly recently, nearly every form of space flight was basically run by national governments. Now there are very exciting things happening. You know, Richard Branson is talking about his Virgin Galactic space flight company, where you can pay, I think it's of the order of £100,000 now, and you'll get a short suborbital flight. And those flights are supposed to be starting within a couple of years. And I think possibly access to space may well change over the next few years from being primarily, you know, big NASA-type missions to commercial companies providing relatively cheap, and I use the word relatively advisedly, access to space. And, of course, once you get the commercial people interested in these things, then anything becomes possible. But I'm very hopeful that certainly within, you know, I would hope by the 2020s we will be back on the moon. And I do think there are reasons for that now. Obviously, as an astronomer, the moon is a great place to do astronomy from. But also, I think it is part of, you know, our human nature to want to explore and go beyond boundaries. And I think the moon and the planets and the solar, you know, our solar system, and beyond that the stars, they really are kind of our future as a civilization. Although absolutely, you know, in times when we have credit crunches and things like that, it's very useful, I think, to say exactly why are we doing these things.
Yeah, well, it'd be interesting. Maybe one day you'll go to travel agents and the moon might be one particular destination you might be able to go to.
Certainly, I think the moon would be a very nice place to go.
Yeah. No atmosphere.
No.
Listen, Ian, it's been great speaking to you. Do you have any recommended websites that people can check out to find out more details?
Well, certainly I would say that the International Year of Astronomy website for the UK is really great, very useful, and it's got pointers to loads of activities and events going on. So if you've never, or if you are, kind of, you've got a passing interest in astronomy, I would go to www.astronomy2009.co.uk.
Yeah,
and you can go from there, and there's loads of really useful links.
And have a little route in the attic and see if there's an old pair of binoculars there.
Absolutely, yes. And then, as I say, my final tip, if you want a quick tip, the best free show of the year, if you're out in August, about the 11th of August, there's a fantastic meteor shower every year. So get those binoculars. Well, you don't need the binoculars. Get a deck chair, a nice drink of your favourite kind of a drink with a deck chair in August, and you'll see tens, if not hundreds, of meteors over the course of the night.
All right, any particular aspect that we're looking for there?
Straight up.
Straight up. That's a good one for me. Listen, Ian, great to speak to you, mate.
Good speaking to you.
City Talk 105.9, the best of Roy Basnett.
Dr. Ian Griffin speaking to us here on City Talk 105.9. Next up, let's meet Kerry Hopkins. Kerry claims she can tell things about you merely by knowing your name. She is somewhat of a celebrity in the United States of America, and she spoke to me here on City Talk.
How you doing, Roy?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm phenomenal.
Are you? What are you up to? Anything of interest? Like, are you out partying?
I'm just sitting here and can't wait to talk to you guys.
Oh, right. Okay, Kerry, for the benefit of those people who, amazingly, some people might not know who you are, Kerry. But if that is the case, you better tell us exactly who you are and what you do.
Okay. Well, I happen to have this freaking knack of knowing what people are like based on their names.
Really?
And I've studied it, researched it, clinically researched. I mean, I'm phenomenal at it. I'm actually an expert, and I've done this in four continents, and I consult all over the world, and I can tell you what you like based on your name.
So does that mean that if somebody's called John, that all Johns are the same?
Well, okay. You have to go by your middle name, your last name. I mean, yes, John. But then it could be John with a J-O-N. It could be John with J-O-H-N. Jonathan. So it makes a whole bit of difference. It does.
Right. Well, that being the case, then I need to put your ability to the test. And my name is Roy, as you know. So go on, tell me all about being Roy.
I love you.
All right.
I genuinely do. I am not joking. If I met a Roy, I'm like, oh, what a good person you are.
Yeah.
Now, you like respect. You definitely do. And you're great for you that you have a talk show because you love to talk. Oh, you love that. And you love to party, too. You're like a really fun person at a party.
Right.
You truly are. But put that all together, I got to tell you the truth. The bad thing about you is that you don't seem to get the accolades that you really deserve, because you really, you deserve so much because you're such a good worker. You give 110% to everybody. And so, but people don't give you credit for it.
Well, that certainly fits in pretty much with the story of my life, actually.
You know.
Well, that's a good start. So, well, tell us, when did you realize that you had this ability then, Kerry?
I was 3. I know it sounds really ridiculous, but I was 3, and I was in nursing school, and this kid bit me. Her name was Amy. I'm like, oh! And I instead of picking on her, I picked on all Amy's. I'm like, oh, Amy's. Stay away from Amy's. And so I generalized at 3 years old a person's name. Isn't that strange? But I did. So ever since then, I've been stereotyping people, and I just know people based on their name. And then I actually went to school for it, and I studied in Oxford, and studied in MIT, and University of Chicago. I mean, at UCLA was where I studied. I mean, it's actually a study, but of people who based on names.
Right. Well, that sounds fascinating stuff. Now, you've got a book out called Breaking the Name Code. What benefits would people have if they were to read that book?
Okay. Well, boy, you could... What you do is, if you got my book, then you could break people... Well, first of all, there's like thousands of names that are interpreted in the book. But also, you can also figure it out how people are based by, like, the letter, like Roy, R. R means respect. You want respect from people. The O means you're stubborn. You are stubborn, Roy. You are. Mm-hmm. But you also love to talk. And so that's so you get to learn that. And then the Y is the party or part, you know, an aspect of your name, but also very secretive because there's a part of you you want to keep to yourself. So if you got my book, that you get every letter and you figure out if you could figure out what people are like based on their name, just like any name on the planet, you can figure out what they're like.
Right. I said, well, there's some advantage in that.
Yeah.
Ah. Now, oh,
so,
what?
I got it here.
Yeah. You must. Sorry, I missed that.
And your, pardon me.
Sorry, I missed that last bit. Go on, carry on.
Oh, I want to hear who else is in your studio. You got to tell me the names.
You what? Sorry.
Yeah, who else is in your studio?
We have a Jonathan. And that's a J. Yeah.
Oh!
Right.
Walk him. He's going places. Like, yeah, I am not joking. He knows how to network. Those people, John Blends, are good at networking. Oh,
right.
He's a nice person. He's friendly. But he's a worker. You know, the guy's a worker. So, oh, good for him.
Well, but I'll tell you what I've got to say. That preceding me, the guy that was on before was a guy by the name of Peter or Pete. What does that suggest to you?
Doesn't he have the best life? Oh, my God. First of all, I love him as a friend. He's a great, generous friend. He's really generous. And he absolutely just fell in his lap. I mean, I don't know how he even got the job, but I mean, it fell in his lap. Not joking. I mean, oh, how he got that? It's amazing. He's a nice guy. He's friendly. Everyone likes him. You know, oh, he's a good person. But I'm not joking. This guy has a privileged life.
Right, so basically, what you're saying is that this job came to him. He didn't have to work for it.
No! He could do the worst job, and he would still keep his job. I'm not kidding.
Oh, my God! I can't wait to tell him. Well, that's going to be good. Well, let's have a look at some of the other people who work here on City Talk 105.9. We have a guy by the name of Duncan.
Duncan? Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, Duncan works for everything he gets. The exact opposite from Pete. Pete gets everything given to him. Duncan has to work for everything. Oh, he's a good person. He's daring. He's defiant. He's social. He's out there. But I'm telling you, he has to work for everything he gets.
Right.
And I feel badly for him on that level.
Mm-hmm.
But he already knows that part about his life.
Right.
And he loves information. He loves to, you know, he'll, oh, gosh, he's informative, and he'll search for he's always looking for truth, you know. And, oh, he's a good person, but he has to earn everything.
Right. What about female names? Can you get anything from female names?
Yeah, what's the name?
Right, Kim.
Kim, oh, good looking.
Yeah.
Isn't she?
Well, yeah. Beauty's in the eye of the beholder, but yeah, no, of course she is. She's very attractive, yeah.
Yeah, of course she is. Oh, she's good looking. Oh, Kim. Now, she's very, jeepers. I like her very much. She's got a lot of personality, but she knows more about everything else going on than she'll let on at all. Oh, she's so good at that.
Right.
So that's her skill in life, is that she knows, she's so good at knowing everyone else's business.
Right. But you could say that about most women, though, couldn't you, really? Well, what about, listen, I've got to ask you this one, Kerry, because you've been giving us some kind of standard traits about the name there, but what about if, because I know in the book that you've got there, you know, if you were looking for romance, if you like, and you were looking for specific aspects of something that were compatible with yourself, how does the name fit in there? For example, how could you tell anything about me and what I'm actually like when it comes to, you know?
Yes. Do you have a partner yet?
You what, sorry? Yes, yes, I do, yeah.
What's the partner's name?
Jane.
Jane? Ooh, I love Jane. I have like a ton of friends who are named Jane.
Right.
Tons of them. They are smart. They are capable. They go after what they want. Oh, I love them. But that's perfect for you, Roy. You know why?
Why?
Because you know why? Because you're just a nice guy. You're not like real assertive. You're not. Like, right. You're not going to argue with me at all. You just won't. And Jane likes to have things done her way, and she's a capable woman, very capable.
Right.
So good for you. You found a woman who's very capable. Get the job done. Oh, you can rely on her. She's dependable. Oh, you did great, right?
I love this. I think this is fantastic. You should take this up professionally, Kerry, I tell you. in terms of yourself, then, over there, because I get the impression, looking at your website and all the kind of shows that you've been on, you're a bit of a celebrity over in the US, aren't you?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I do a lot of shows. That is true.
Yeah. Okay. Well, tell us about. I haven't asked the ultimate question yet. Tell us about Kerry. What does that name mean?
Okay. Well, Kerri, Kerry. I you got the K. The K brings personality. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So she likes to be center of attention. She loves that. But she also, oh gosh, a girl named with ER at the end. Oh my God. We have problems. We have total issues. Like you can't believe. Like. Think of a Terry. Think of a, oh, gosh, Sherry. Anything with an ER, we have huge issues because we are always trying to prove ourselves. We always, it's awful that way. So whereas a guy with it, the same ER, doesn't mean anything. What they do is it manifests in them working really hard to prove themselves. And they work, you know, three jobs just to get ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's the girl with the ER, oh, jeepers, it's not good.
Right.
Anyway, so but I got the 2 R's, which means I want respect. I really do. Even though I want to have fun, I just want to have respect. And the I means I'm a total flirt. So.
Right. That's a good thing. Yeah. Well, I've got to say, actually, I would have to say, based on your little demonstration of ability there, it seems to fit in pretty well with the names and the personalities that I know of the people that you've mentioned. So you seem to be validating your gift here to me.
No, thanks, Ray.
That's going to be good. So then, I mean, what's the kind of future view? What do you intend to do with this ability? Have you got any long-term plan?
Well, what I do is it's the strangest thing. You would not believe me if I told you, but the truth is corporations hire me to do to find out who buys, the major retailers of the United States. They want to figure out how the buying power of people are based on their names.
Right.
And then juries, they hire me because they want to. Lawyers want to hire me because they want to know how they can stack a jury to see who's going to be pro prosecution or pro defendant.
Right.
Or it's unbelievable. Anything with a name is unbelievable.
So why? So if this is the case, then that you can extract something from somebody's name, and you know, for the benefit of those people who've just joined us, we're talking with Kerry Hopkins here, who can pretty much determine your personality and character just by your name. Are we talking about something a bit spiritual here? Because I mean, people randomly pick names for their children, or do they?
I know. I honestly don't know about that, but I do know that. I've done tons of research on people who've changed their names and how it's changed your personality. So I do think a name definitely, it's how you perceive yourself and how other people perceive you.
Right.
So I know there's something to this. I know there is.
Okay.
And I don't know about the parents basing, you know, naming you, but I do, I'm positive that if you change your name, you can change your life.
Right. All sounds pretty good to me. Kerry, tell us about your websites, please.
Oh, you're so nice. Well, I got this great website called namezook.com, ZOOK.com. And you can go log on and you can personally find out what your name is for free. It's a limited analysis. I got to tell you the truth. It's limited.
Mm-hmm.
But you can find out what you're like, and that's free of charge.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to know what you personally are like full, like your first, middle, and last name, then you can also, you know, go on the site for that too.
Right. Excellent. And that's called NameZook?
NameZook.com. And then my other one is it's called BreakingTheNameCode.com, the same in my book. So if you want to get the book, you can figure it out for yourself what people are like, or or as you can see, you know, I do goofy things on my site, you know. So if you want to do that, you can do that too.
Yeah. What's the other one? Is it YourSuchADave.com?
Yeah, my very, very first book was called YourSuchADave.com. my first book was called You're Such a Dave. And my brother goes, well, that's just your opinion. And I go, well, yeah, I know, but I know I'm right. And and then since then, I did 6 years of clinical research. So right. Now it's breaking the name code, and also You're Such a Dave. Right. But I know what I'm talking about with people with the names. I'm positive.
Right.
I'm good at this.
Well, you certainly proved it to me. Anyway, I don't need any more demonstrations. Anyway, well, listen, it's been wonderful speaking to you, Kerry.
Yeah,
really do appreciate that. And hopefully we can catch up with you again sometime.
I would love that.
And that's this week's podcast from the Roy Basnett Show on City Talk 105.9. Don't forget, you can join me live on the radio each weekday morning between 2 and 6 a.m. on City Talk across the Northwest and North Wales on 105.9 FM or DAB Digital Radio. And of course, you can listen live online at citytalk.fm. That's it for now. We'll catch you next time.
City Talk 105.9, the best of Roy Basnett. Listen, and log on to the voice of Liverpool. City Talk 105.9.